politics, police, and the pandemic economy. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Election Day is less than 2 months away. Vote-by-mail ballots go out in just a few weeks, and the top-of-the-ticket candidates are visiting South Florida. How are they competing for your vote? If you're undecided, what messages are resonating with you? Then, police oversight measures move forward, but critics warn they don't go far enough. Broward County commissioners heard from the public this week.
For a board of this type to be meaningful, it must hold police directly accountable and provide justice to those harmed by police.
And how's your job? The pandemic has hit the South Florida job market hard. Local governments have responded with a patchwork of programs. What's helping get people back to work? The South Florida Roundup made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. The presidential election campaign officially arrived in South Florida this week. President Trump was in Jupiter on Tuesday, highlighting his environmental record. He signed an executive order extending and expanding a ban on offshore oil drilling off of Florida's waters.
With fracking, the shale revolution, and the tremendous surge in American energy production, we're showing that we can create jobs, safeguard the environment, and keep energy prices low for America and low for our citizens.
Also this week, new polling out showing that the president tailing former Vice President Joe Biden in Miami-Dade County. That poll finds that the president, President Trump, does have a small lead over the former vice president, however, among Latinos in Miami-Dade County. Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, visited Miami on Thursday. She and her husband spoke in Miami Gardens and Aventura, hoping to court a broad swath of South Florida voters.
Because I am here on behalf of myself and Joe Biden to listen and learn, to ensure that the work that we are doing and intend to do is relevant to the people of this community. And it is about lifting them up and seeing and hearing them.
Presidential politics begins this week across South Florida here on the Roundup. Are you undecided about your vote in the upcoming election? What issues are you most concerned about as the candidates come to South Florida courting your vote? What are you hearing or what are you not hearing? Are you attending those events? Are you watching them virtually, perhaps? Join the conversation live on this Friday here on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN. Talking politics for the first part of our program, 800-743-9576. We're also on Twitter. Look for us at WLRN. Anthony Mann is with us covering politics for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Anthony, welcome back to the Roundup. Nice to have you again.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So let's talk about the president's visit, first of all, in Jupiter. How was this environmental policy action surprising that brought him to South Florida?
Well, in a certain sense, it's not really surprising at all. It might show an element of chutzpah, but not really surprise. Obviously, we know that offshore drilling is very, very important in South Florida, and really the entire state. People in Florida do not like it. Polling has consistently shown that. Actually, except for Republicans. Republicans polling shows have support offshore drilling. It was a great opportunity for the president to present himself as somebody who is good on the environment and good on an environmental issue that a lot of people care about. The part of it that really isn't surprising is Governor DeSantis has been pushing for quite a while the narrative that President Trump would be with Florida on offshore drilling. And at the opportune time, the kickoff of the fall campaign, they had a chance for the president to tell us that.
Yeah. Has he always been with Florida and the governor by prohibiting offshore drilling, or is this something that he was holding kind of in that campaign back pocket for this kind of moment?
Well, the administration's policy has been quite consistent that it favors fossil fuel exploration everywhere and has favored offshore drilling all along the U.S. coast. So this is something that is an election year issue or position. Democrats were quick to point out that what he announced doesn't have the force of law, and it could be reversed not only by any future president, it could be reversed by President Trump the day after the election, or if he's reelected any time in a second term.
So let's talk strategy here a little bit, Anthony, because the president does come from to South Florida to talk about this environment issue, this environmental issue, and draw some attention to that environmental record from his administration. How would you describe that environmental record as it relates to the environmental issues in South Florida specifically?
Well, environmentalists pretty much uniformly say it's a terrible record, that everything he has done exacerbates the most important environmental issue in South Florida, and that's climate change and sea level rise. So the environmental community thinks that this is a completely phony pitch on the part of the president. What the president may be doing, as he seems to be doing in some other areas, may not be trying to convince people that he's really such an environmental champion, because his record would seem to indicate otherwise. The head of the Interior Department is a former fossil fuel lobbyist. The head of the EPA is a former coal industry lobbyist. What he may be trying to do is to show whatever pool of on-the-fence moderate voters that he isn't quite as egregious as the picture that's being painted of him. So it may be trying to send a message to those voters.
Let's take a look at that picture that Democrats are certainly trying to paint of the president. Lois Frankel, the Democratic congresswoman in Palm Beach County, described the president's environmental record this way.
For the fourth year in a row, Trump proposed to slash the budgets of the EPA that protects our clean water and air, and energy and interior departments, prioritizing corporate polluters over climate crisis and public health.
So, Anthony, that is part of that picture that, of course, the opposition is trying to paint of the president. This environmental message, is it shoring up the president's support? As you talk about that kind of maybe undecided, on-the-fence, moderate voter, is the environment that issue to get that voter off the fence and into the Trump camp? Or is it some other issue?
The environment in and of itself may not be. It may be more part trying to create a broader narrative that the president is somebody who isn't the kind of bomb thrower, explosive type of character that many people feel they've seen over the past 4 years, and part of an overall narrative. I don't think even in South Florida, where environmental issues are critical, I don't think there's evidence that shows that it is really an issue that's going to move a lot of people. I know there are some activists and very passionate people who would feel otherwise, but I think the issues that are going to move people, if issues really do move people at all, are going to be the big ones, such as the coronavirus.
I laugh a little there, Anthony, because I know you as a very strong veteran political reporter. We like to cover issues. We like to talk about issues, but sometimes races come down to personalities. Oftentimes they can come down to personalities, familiarity. And another word that we've heard frequently over the last 4 years and probably in play, certainly this 2020 cycle, which is character, and for voters to decide the type of character that they're looking for at the top of the ticket. We're talking presidential politics in South Florida with Anthony Mann with South Florida Sun Sentinel. Join our conversation. What are you seeing? What are you hearing from the candidates? What's appealing to you or turning you off? Or if you are one of those rare undecided voters still in this election cycle, let us know where you are on the fence and which way you may be leaning, and what's going to push you over one way or the other. 800-743-WLRN. That's our live phone number on this Friday afternoon to join our call, to join our conversation. 800-743-9576 or at WLRN on Twitter. Anthony, we did see the Democratic vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris, come to South Florida, come to Dade County specifically. What did this mark for the Biden campaign? Is it kind of reinforcing, or is it kind of acknowledgement that what some of the polling is showing is that the Biden ticket is not running as strong as, for instance, the Hillary Clinton ticket was running with some South Florida Democrats 4 years ago?
I think really it acknowledges the inevitable that they were going to show up. The Biden campaign was going to show up in Florida, and particularly South Florida, where it's essential to have a very strong Democratic margin coming out of the three South Florida counties, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. So they were going to come down here at some point. They were going to have to start doing that. Senator Harris touched key Democratic constituencies. She made this stop, in Doral, the Venezuelan community, the Black community in Miami Gardens at Florida Memorial, and then her husband, who's Jewish, met with rabbis and Jewish politicians. So they did the things that any candidate, particularly a Democrat, has to do and is always going to do, and they needed to get started on that because people start voting very soon.
Yeah. To that timing here, you know, it came the same week that we began to see some statewide surveys as well as some local county polling in Dade County about the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, particularly statewide, and how the Biden ticket does not have the margin of victory, for instance, that Hillary Clinton had 4 years ago. How is that resonating, though, just beyond the specific Hispanic vote, but more generally, particularly Democratic voters in Broward County, which has been a stronghold for Democrats and a place that national campaigns have had to focus on and have come up short in terms of turnout over the past couple of larger election cycles?
Well, that has been, as you know, a huge focus is getting that turnout from Broward County, all of South Florida, but especially Broward County. Actually, right. Hillary Clinton's campaign did well with that in 2016. For the last full week of the campaign, out of 7 days, she spent parts of 4 days in Broward County. Hmm. She got an enormous boost out of Broward County. The problem for her in winning the statewide contest is then-candidate Donald Trump, adding up all the smaller counties in the state, he boosted the number for Republicans much more in the smaller, more rural counties, had an even greater percentage. So she did well in Broward, and it's just that Trump did better. Democrats really have to work to make sure they can hit those levels that she did in Broward County. And there is the room for them to do that. I mean, they need to do outreach to the African-American, Caribbean-American community, and they certainly mm-hmm. will be doing that.
Yeah. 800-743-WLRN, talking politics here with Anthony Mann. He's been watching and covering politics for a good long time here in South Florida. He is with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Your phone calls at 800-743-WLRN. Rama in Jupiter is along with us on line five. Rama, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And you're mentioning the rare undecided voters. I happen to be one of those. I'm 29.
We found one. Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us here. tell us about riding the fence then here.
Absolutely. You know, I'm 29, so I'm what you would call a millennial, I suppose. Yet I believe in everything earned and nothing given. At the same time, I believe in many progressive environmental policies and, of course, women's rights. So right now I'm registered as a Republican, voted for Donald Trump, but I voted for Obama before that. And it's just, you can't get everything, which is why I'm on the fence. I wish, you know, there was a Republican candidate that believed in environmental protection more so than what it is right now. And I wish that there would be a Democratic candidate who believed in, you know, more conservative fiscal policies and smaller government. I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on that, but I tend to vote that way locally. It's just hard to find out, you know, how to vote in the general election that way.
Yeah, you know, Rama, you represent the golden ticket for either political party at this point, the undecided, relatively young voter, someone who has voted, who has switched votes, it sounds like. In 2012 and in 2016. In 12, you voted Democratic for President Obama and for then-candidate Trump in 2016. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And now you're still trying to find that candidate who's going to earn your vote. Will you vote? number one for president.
Absolutely. There's no greater sin than not voting.
And will you vote for one of the two major party candidates, either President Trump or former Vice President Biden?
I will. I'm not going to vote for a third party. It would be a wasted vote, I think.
Rama, hold the line here with us. Anthony, this is a voter who, this is the needle in the haystack that the campaigns want to go after. That's why they're coming here. That's why the candidates are here. That's why our mailboxes are full of pamphlets, and why in commercial television and commercial radio and on YouTube and other places we're just bombarded with these ads. What do you hear from this uncommitted millennial voter, Anthony?
I think it's really interesting hearing what he has to say, and that really is there's neither candidate meets the criteria that he set out. So it's how do you pick between the two candidates, because one of them will be the next president. And third party candidates, it may be a nice idea, but realistically, either Trump or Biden will be president in January 2021. And it's also interesting that he mentioned particular issues and not sort of the character and personality and moral equation when it comes to the two choices that we have.
Yeah. Does that weigh into your considerations at all, Rama? The character question, the rhetoric that the candidates use? Rama, you still with us?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. The character question that Anthony spoke about, you mentioned specific issues, policies, certainly important to you. What about the question of character and leadership? Do those come into your calculus?
Well, certainly leadership, but the character question is so subjective. I think everybody gets pummeled by the media on both sides, Democratic and Republican. So I tend to filter that out, because how is anybody to know? I don't know these people, but I do know what policies they're pushing forward, and that's why it's difficult for me to choose.
Yeah. Hold the line with
question.
This here.
May I ask one more question?
Anthony.
Actually, two. When are you going to decide, and are you going to watch at least the first presidential debate?
I'll definitely watch the first presidential debate. The question of deciding will be, at any time. In fact, the scales tipped just recently because the president was at making a speech right in front of the Jupiter Lighthouse in my community. I didn't go to it, but I read some of the notes of what he said. And, he spoke on environmental protections, or at least proposing, more money to protect the Florida coastline or, what have you. So that was a benefit. That was a good thing. If there was something like that on the Biden camp that, say he spoke more about protecting our, Second Amendment rights, or, smaller government, less tax sort of thing, and that would push me in that direction. But right now, the scale just got tipped a little.
Rama, I appreciate you sharing your perspective with us, and stay in touch, okay?
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. And Anthony, always great to spend a little bit of time with you and dig into your reporter's notebook. Appreciate you sharing your reporting with us here on the Roundup.
Thanks, anytime.
Yeah, Anthony Mann, a veteran political reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. We got a lot more to talk about here this week on the South Florida Roundup. A busy week news-wise. We want to hear your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. From politics to police, police oversight groups are driving debates among lawmakers in Broward and Miami-Dade counties about oversight. We want to hear your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Nationwide protests over police violence continue. Demonstrators calling on lawmakers to hold law enforcement officers more accountable. Among proposed actions, creating or strengthening police review boards. Now, those boards could be tasked with making policy recommendations as well as investigate complaints against police officers. Miami-Dade County is set to reinstitute a police review panel. Commissioners in Broward County debated a similar proposal this week. So what would you want a local police review board to do? Who should serve in that group? What should its powers be? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, talking about police review boards. You can also tweet us at WLRN. WLRN's Katie Switalski, Broward County reporter, with us here first. Katie, tell us more about this proposal that was debated in Broward County and then ultimately delayed in terms of any action being taken until sometime later on in the month.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, so County Mayor Dale Holness proposed an ordinance that would create this, you know, whatever you call it, if you call it a citizens review board or a police and criminal justice review board, would create one at a county level for Broward. And I should just note, you know, Fort Lauderdale, some other cities have their own city level boards, but this would be on a little bit of a bigger scale for the county. And so long story short, what the commission ultimately did after a few hours of talking about this was defer a vote. They're waiting on the county attorney to make some amendments to the mayor's proposal, and they're going to come back and talk about it again on October 6th, which kind of pushes it down the road a little bit because they really wanted to vote on it at a public hearing on September 22nd. But several commissioners really wanted to see some changes before that came up.
You mentioned the county attorney, Andrew Myers. Myers was concerned about the legality of what a police review board can do under Florida state law. This is what he said during the commission meeting on Thursday.
We should not be doing anything that would intrude into the field of disciplining officers. That's the primary restriction.
Tell us a little bit about that primary restriction, as he calls it. This is solely the territory of state law, not of a local police review board, Katie?
Well, the state of Florida gives a lot of power to police law enforcement employers to discipline them. So the question comes into play of, is it the appropriate place of a group of nominated citizens to decide someone's work discipline, whether or not they should be suspended with pay, suspended without pay? Those are significant questions. And so I think this really kind of gets to the heart of the issue of what a lot of citizens who called in during public comment got to yesterday, which was, you know, what's the point of a citizen review board if they're not going to have a lot of power? It's a nice idea, but what are they actually going to be able to accomplish? And so the way this is written in Broward County right now, the review board would have subpoena power, potentially. That's still getting hammered out, but it's in the proposal. And then, the board would basically be a data analysis looking at patterns and trends of excessive use of force cases, looking at cases after the fact, after they've been closed. Then they can come back to the county commission and say, hey, we noticed there's a lot of excessive force cases in this area or under these conditions, and sort of bring that bird's eye view. But it's not like they can be the intermediary taking action very quickly when a high profile case arises.
Yeah, the question of power of these police review boards is also at the heart of the debate happening just south of Broward County in Miami-Dade County. We're talking about police review boards and local law enforcement here on the South Florida Roundup. 800-743-WLRN. This is a debate that's been ongoing, has certainly gotten hot over the past few months as we've seen public demonstrations regarding law enforcement violence nationwide, including some demonstrations here in South Florida. 800-743-WLRN is our phone number, or at WLRN on Twitter to add your voice to this conversation. Danny Rivero is a voice we're going to add right now, who is a reporter here at WLRN. You've been following the development of the police review board debate in Dade County. What's the status of that effort to create this police review board, or perhaps more accurately, bring it back after it went away about a decade ago?
Right. So the current status of it is that just a few weeks ago, the Board of County Commissioners here in Miami-Dade gave an approval for it, and they voted to reinstate it. And Mayor Carlos Jimenez actually said that he would not veto it, which is really significant because over the last 2 years, he twice vetoed similar resolutions that would recreate this kind of board. So as of now, it is going to happen. The exact dates for when it's going to start meeting, when it's going to start happening, has yet to be hammered out. But this is something that's coming back to Dade County pretty soon.
And in what form does it look like? What changes have been made to get and garner support and keep the support that it's had originally?
Right. So there's a couple things. So it's going to have 13 members that will be one appointed by each county commissioner. It's going to have no more than two members of the same profession will be allowed on it. So say you can't stack it with people who are former police officers. You can't stack it with doctors if you wanted to. There's going to be a limitation on that front. And the major holdup with Mayor Jimenez was he really did not want this authority to have subpoena power over any kind of county employee, whether it's the mayor himself or any county commissioners or any county employees. So the version that passed does not have the authority to subpoena county employees, which many of whom are actually Miami-Dade County police officers. So they will not have the ability to issue subpoenas. But they will be able to investigate citizen complaints, use of force incidents, and kind of rehash closed internal affairs investigations and air them out in a public setting. And the findings of those investigations will all be much more public than say, an internal affairs investigation.
Talking about police review board debates happening in Miami-Dade County and this week in Broward County with Danny Rivera. You just heard from him. He's a reporter here at WLRN. Katie Swatulski is also on the line. Katie covers Broward County for us here. Let's go to Lake Worth where Noam is with us. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes. So I just wanted to speak about, well, a couple of things. One, if the representation, if there isn't representation and voices from people directly from the impacted communities on such a review board, if it were created, and then it would be, if they're not included, then it would be, frankly, pointless. So that would be sort of a requirement. You know, I'd hate for, like, some citizen, quote, citizen review board to be created, and it, you know, it not to have representation from people from the impacted communities. And the second thing I wanted to bring up is that, you know, the sheriff's office also oversees the jails. And, you know, we see with our eyes what happens on the streets, but behind those walls, we don't see what's happening. And, you know, I've been volunteering on a hotline for the last several months since April that has been taking hundreds of calls from Broward and Palm Beach and from people from within the jails. And the accounts that are coming out, not just about sort of treatment by the guards, but also about medical and health neglect, is horrific. And
yeah,
those
you bring
are
up
the kinds of things that a review board should also definitely oversee.
Noam, you bring up two important points. Let's address quickly that second one, though, regarding kind of oversight reach of these police review boards. Katie, in Broward County, what they're debating, would it reach in to correctional facilities, to jails?
That really didn't come up yesterday. I think they're far more worried about closed cases and more of a data analysis perspective. But there's arguments, absolutely, and to Noam's point, it came up yesterday in citizen comment that if you don't have people from jails, from community organizing groups, then it's not going to satisfy what people are asking for. So that's absolutely a concern.
Danny, how about in Dade County?
Right. So, you know, this is actually interesting because it's you know, great, you know, tidbit from the caller. So in Miami-Dade County, the resolution that passed does allow any law enforcement agency established by the county to be included in this. And it was not something that was exclusively explicitly brought up, but the county corrections, which in Miami-Dade County, we don't have a sheriff office yet, so it's run by the county, it does appear that that would fall under the purview of this board. So that looks like it can be in the works.
Danny Rivera continuing our reporting in Miami-Dade County. Katie Swatulski doing much the same in Broward County with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Danny and Katie, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us here on this Friday.
Thanks, Tom.
We got plenty more to come, folks. Again, busy week here, 6 months into the coronavirus pandemic. How local governments could sustain economic recovery. Try to spark it. How's your job going? How has the pandemic affected your paycheck? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The economic recovery efforts are underway in South Florida as the pandemic continues, stretching into more than 6 months now. Governor Ron DeSantis announced on this Friday afternoon that Broward and Miami-Dade counties are joining Palm Beach County and the rest of the state in phase two of reopening starting Monday. A year ago, one in every 30 people who wanted a job could not find one in South Florida. Record low unemployment. This summer, that jumped to one out of every eight couldn't find a job. Big spike in joblessness. South Florida has had the second highest unemployment rate in the state, second only to Orlando. And it's just evidence of how vulnerable the local job market has been to the public health measures taken to slow the spread of COVID-19. So let's talk about the pandemic, the economic consequences, and efforts and policies to try to restoke hiring in South Florida. Has your job been affected by the pandemic? Has your paycheck been affected? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is our live phone number here on this Friday afternoon. Or you can join us on social media on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. The federal stimulus checks have come and gone. $600 a week, the boost to unemployment from the federal government has been cut in half for those eligible for it and for those who've successfully navigated the troubled Florida unemployment system. There's no new federal stimulus package coming as Republicans and Democrats in Capitol Hill argue over the spending and specifics. Local governments, meantime, offering their own efforts to help people pay for rent, food, and basic needs. The programs have seen big demand. What's needed now? And into the future to rebuild the local workforce. Ali Bustamante is with us now, senior research affiliate at Florida International University, author of the report released just last week, State of Working Florida. The report gives an overview of economic trends in Florida for the past year. Also with us, William Luther, an economics professor at Florida Atlantic University. To Ali and William, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Ali, let's start with your look and surveying the economic conditions of Florida's job market. How would you compare the conditions today here amidst the pandemic to what we experienced locally during the Great Recession?
You know, that's a great question. You know, when we're looking at the Great Recession, we're looking at a loss of about 900,000 jobs over a period of about 3 years. And just to put it in contrast, over the first 2 months of this pandemic, we lost 1.2 million jobs. Now, we've actually recovered about half of those jobs so far, but what we know is that we keep having increased claims of unemployment compensation, and we have actually still have a deficit of about 600,000 jobs and about 400,000 folks who have left the labor force and have yet to come back.
Yeah, those folks leaving the labor force, what do they represent in terms of the economic casualties that maybe some of these monthly economic statistics just don't pick up on?
You know, many times when folks think about the unemployment rate, they think about folks who may be collecting unemployment compensation and not really looking for a job. When we're looking at the labor force statistics, those folks are actually not considered unemployed. When there's a phenomenon where folks look at the labor market and they basically see a labor market that is really too hard to find a job, where the jobs available are just not paying sufficient wages to make it worth their while. And so they actually forego not just wages and jobs, but actually even unemployment compensation. And in return, oftentimes they, you know, revert back to either going back to school or other kinds of maybe family care circumstances.
It's what economists will call sometimes structural long-term unemployment, a big worry, certainly. William Luther with Florida Atlantic University. For those workers who had been part of the workforce a year ago and now are not participating, even if they don't have work, what's the concern there longer term as we see continued population growth? We see South Florida already is a high-cost of living place to call home, and we're seeing, you know, businesses continue to struggle.
Well, one of the things that you should keep in mind is that when you're on the job, you're also gaining on the job skills. And so if you're not on the job, you're not gaining those skills. And when we look at counties here in South Florida, right, in Broward County, there are about 129,000 fewer people employed this July compared to last July. In Miami-Dade, the employment numbers are down about 205,000. In Palm Beach County, down about 98,000. And so all of those people who would typically be employed, they're not employed, and so they're not gaining those on-the-job skills that they would typically be gaining.
And Ali, the concern is that they don't have an opportunity to get back into the workforce. So the job bounce that we've seen that you referred to, these are not necessarily new jobs, are they? Or is it a matter of folks who had been furloughed? So in other words, kind of laid off, but yet promised a job if work were to come back, and they've been able to come back as we've seen some of this phased economic reopening happen in South Florida.
That's exactly right. When we're looking at the job deficit that we've actually closed to some extent, we lost over a million jobs. We've actually regained about half of those. When we're thinking about regaining them, it's exactly what you said. It's temporary unemployment, temporary layoffs, where workers have actually been recalled, and for the greater part of that population have returned to their prior employer. Now, this is really a testament going to, you know, what you are mentioning about the value of employment in and of itself, that folks will forgo unemployment compensation, even, again, especially as difficult as it has been to obtain, in order to preserve their relationship with their prior employer.
And as we're seeing phased reopening here in South Florida, William, you've looked at the use of stay-at-home orders and economic activity. We saw those stay-at-home orders in March and April, certainly. Haven't seen them really since. So what have you found in terms of the effect of those stay-at-home orders on the economy? Did orders to stay at home in the springtime do undue harm to the local job market?
Well, certainly in early March and April, people were staying at home. But my own research, as you mentioned, which looks at Google mobility data, so cell phone tracking data, finds that it wasn't the stay-at-home orders that caused the decline in activity there in March. It was just people choosing to stay at home. They were assessing the risks, and they did what they thought was best for themselves and their families. And so here in South Florida, you see the stay-at-home the residential activity increase and the retail and recreational activity decrease beginning around March 19th, March 20th, March 21st. So well before we're requiring people to stay at home. Of course, when we've had these phased reopenings, with each phase, you see people going out more, and those Google Mobility series pick that up. And so although those stay-at-home orders, they don't seem to be binding there at the beginning, people were choosing to stay at home, they have been more binding on the back end. And so from my view, the reopening that we've experienced has probably been a bit slower than most people would prefer.
In terms of the economic bounce back that could be that had the potential there, based upon folks kind of getting back out into the economy and interacting with it.
That's right. So if you look at there in early March, you see people, they realized there was a big risk out there. They took steps to protect themselves from those risks, and a big step was staying at home.
Yeah.
But if you look today, they're assessing those risks. You know, Florida never turned into New York. Far fewer deaths here in Florida, despite having a relatively older population. And so individuals are updating their beliefs about those risks. They're ready to get out there to, at least to some extent, to go back to work, to continue purchasing goods and services. But to some extent, those restrictions on economic activity is preventing them from doing that.
We're talking about pandemic economics, but really talking about jobs, your job, your paycheck, your economic mobility, your ability to find a job or find a new job and to pay for the cost of life here in South Florida. What have you experienced over the last 6 months of the pandemic? Share your voice here as an employee, a business owner, maybe someone who's retired and has been watching this. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Ali Bustamante with Florida International University is with us, as well as William Luther with Florida Atlantic University. Let's go to North Miami, where Bill is joining us on line three. Bill, thanks for holding on. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes. Well, my business has been affected. I'm a dental technician. Dental laboratory has been affected. I just want to say at this point that where there wasn't leadership from the top, the White House, down to Tallahassee with the governor, this pandemic has extended further and is worse than it could have been had it been treated initially and properly. Had now we have shutdowns in different regulations in different counties within our state, and it's like whack-a-mole. I mean, you need to have a coherent, unified strategy. And the way I see this right now, our local economies and the average working person won't be able to recover financially until there's a vaccine available, which probably won't be for another year or plus. And this need not have happened from day one, because once I saw what was happening in Europe, and I'm not a medical professional, I could see that we needed to stockpile the medical equipment, and then when the press found out about it, say, well, that's for our NATO partners should they need it, and then for every one piece of medical equipment going to Europe to help them out, keep nine for us as plan B.
So, yeah, Bill, I hear you. Tell us a little bit more about how the pandemic has affected you, if you could share that with us.
Sure. Well, when we shut down, dental offices were closed, which meant dental laboratories didn't have any work. So that affected us immediately. Secondly, most people really don't feel comfortable going to a dentist unless they have a toothache. I mean, that may be normal under normal circumstances. It certainly is under this pandemic. So you're dealing with somebody whose mouth is open, and obviously dentists have their concern as well, with even with N95 masks.
Sure.
But nevertheless, it's affected my line of work, sure.
Are you back at work at all, Bill?
Partially. Like, in other words, my income has substantially decreased.
Yeah. Bill, I appreciate you sharing your story there from North Miami. Thank you. Ali Bustamante, what do you hear there from Bill? Back at work, but the income has been hit because of the hours worked. And he clearly is really pessimistic about a bounce back until there's a vaccine in widespread usage.
And he starts to be, I'm equally concerned as he is, as Bill is. You know, when we're looking at the pandemic, we know that this is something unlike, unlike a natural disaster that we've experienced in the past. It's unlike a hurricane. You know, it's not something where we just patch up, give folks temporary assistance, whether it's housing, whether it's food subsidies. What we're ultimately looking at here is a drastically different phenomenon. One that, as Bill mentioned, will ultimately show our way forward through a vaccine. However, because we really don't have vaccine in sight, we really have to, in terms of particularly municipal policy and state and federal policy, make these kind of long-term investments, long-term plans into how we can ultimately address this critical problem of large levels of unemployment and the significant wage law that has occurred throughout our communities. The idea of providing a few million dollars for rental assistance is really a drop in the bucket when what folks really ultimately need are sustainable jobs.
You're referring maybe to, for instance, efforts in Miami for a $10 million rent relief program, or tens of millions of dollars in other kinds of local relief efforts that are paid through the Federal CARES Act that local governments have been working on. What are part of the policy prescriptions, Ali, that ought to be on the menu for this current budget cycle that local governments are in right now, with budget years beginning in October, and also longer term, the kinds of investments that they ought to be talking about?
Oh, absolutely. And, we actually don't have to look very far when we look at the different models that are available to South Florida cities. For example, in of all places, Birmingham, Alabama, they've actually had a very comprehensive response to COVID, where they actually leveraged those federal dollars that they received from the CARES Act to ultimately create a service corps, where the city is doing direct hiring for community projects. they've actually created a public-private partnership where they're ultimately working with employers as well as nonprofits to not just provide, you know, temporary assistance, again, whether it's rental, food, or otherwise, but actually to create, to foster infrastructure, to, you know, invest in public works projects, projects that create jobs, but actually create considerable value down the line that will actually boost these local economies.
William Luther with the FAU, does that kind of public spending scare away private investment?
Pessimistic
William
here
Luther?
About the,
yeah.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
We can hear you now. Yes, sir.
I'm a little more pessimistic here about the local efforts, at least the local efforts that I've seen here in South Florida. In general, the available funding has been quite limited. It hasn't been easy for businesses to access that funding, and the process for selecting eligible businesses has not been very transparent. So the agencies that are doling out these funds, they're just not very well suited for picking winners and losers. So take Palm Beach County, for example. They received $261 million from the CARES Act and set aside about $60 million for restart business grants to businesses, some with 25 or fewer employees and some with more. Now, $60 million sounds like a lot of money to you or me, but there are around 50,000 employers, employer businesses in Palm Beach County. And so that's just about $1,200 per business. And that's not counting the roughly 200,000 non-employer businesses like real estate agents or independent contractors and things like that. So it's just not a lot of funding. And on top of the county level efforts, there are also, you know, city efforts, right. And you know, with so many sources of funds, it's just very difficult for entrepreneurs to find out what they're eligible for, and frankly, they just didn't have much time to figure that out. So the Palm Beach County program that I mentioned, it was approved on May 15th, and they stopped accepting applications on June 12th. So they had less than a month to find out about this program and apply for it. It's just difficult to think that a lot of businesses who really needed those funds were able to jump through those hoops in time.
Ali, in our final couple of moments, I'd like you to kind of reflect about this moment for South Florida and the economy. Particularly hard hit is your research, and William Luther, you know this as well because of the hospitality focus of the economy. What should, frankly, workers and leaders be thinking about in terms of this opportunity to diversify the economy to make it more economically resilient?
Absolutely, yes. In terms of workers, you know, these are critical moments right now where a lot of universities and colleges and technical schools are actually embracing this moment to upskill, workers and particularly not your non-traditional student in really innovative ways. There's been actually a good amount of funding that has allowed these, higher education institutions to be much more flexible in the way that they offer, this training and these credentials than they had in the past. So it really, again, thinking about the unforeseeable end for this pandemic and really the lengthy recovery that is likely ahead. You know, we did not close the job deficit from the Great Recession for about 4 years. And so we'll be thinking, again, that we are going to be in this sustained period of higher unemployment, and especially, again, in these sectors such as hospitality, which lost about 1 in 5 jobs. A lot of those business closures have occurred. And so we have to think of, particularly from the leadership side, is that there's no one type of silver bullet that can do it all. Where it's Jimmy Butler can't have the team by himself, or Lonzo Ball.
Right. We've got to leave it there. Apologies for cutting you off. Ali Bustamante with FIU, along with us here on the South Florida Roundup, joined from Florida Atlantic University, William Luther. Thanks, fellas. Finally, on the roundup this week. Today, this Friday, marks 19 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Thousands of 9/11 survivors and first responders live here in Florida, and they suffer health problems that stem from that time. Richard Yodici retired in Boynton Beach. He spent 5 months working near Ground Zero to restore electricity to Lower Manhattan. Last year, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he spoke on WLRN's Sundial program this week about how the coronavirus pandemic had him more fearful about his health.
Been in the house, I don't go food shopping. Maybe one or two of my close friends that come over from Palm Beach, we don't go out to eat. I canceled my trip to New York. I was supposed to go for my granddaughter's communion in May. I usually go to New York for 4 to 6 weeks, and I had to cancel that, so she received her communion. My immune system, they say, is not the same, and I do take blood pressure medication. I guess I'm going to be kind on myself and say I'm a few pounds overweight. I'm a big guy. So my cousins are coming from New York next month, and luckily they're coming down for 6-7 weeks. So I says, well, I won't be seeing you for 14 days. And they understand.
Richard Yodici, retired to Boynton Beach. You can hear more of Luis Hernandez's interview with him at WLRN.org. Look for Sundial under the radio tab on our homepage. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexandra Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and our technical supervisor is Peter Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.